What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, trying to figure some things out about why do Catholics do this and this and this? Why do they not believe this and this and this? Let's talk about that. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening outside of the U.S. and Canada, then you'll want to dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And if you're watching us on TV today, you can participate as well. Our email address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Ryan Penny is our phone screener. We also have Jeff Burson on social media, and he's taking a look right now at YouTube and Facebook. So if you want to pose a question there, he'll pass it on to us here in the studio. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, thanks.
Glad to hear that. As we're getting some of these calls screened, we're going to go to this email from Patrick. I've never heard this one before. I have a friend who says the Catholic Church was started by the Roman Emperor Constantine, not by Jesus Christ. How would you respond? Did the emperor play a major role in the expansion of the Catholic Church? Thanks, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So there's a little problem with that hypothesis, and that is that the Roman Emperor Constantine lived 300 years or so after Christ's ascension, and there's a lot of Catholic history that takes place in that period. And so when Constantine became a Catholic on his deathbed, there was such a thing as a Catholic Church for him to join. And he assimilated himself into that previously existing ecclesiastical organization when the Council of Nicaea was held to determine the question of Christ's divinity. And Constantine had a hand in saying that that council took place. He had an interest in the Christians in his empire coming to one mind and stopping their internal wrangling over doctrinal matters. He didn't go out and appoint bishops to name to that council. He invited bishops. They were already bishops because emperors don't make bishops, right? Other bishops do.
That's right.
And the guys that showed up, many of them were a pretty motley crew of injuries and missing eyeballs and, you know, missing limbs and so forth, because they had endured the persecutions of the previous Roman emperors who had persecuted the Catholic Church and tried to eliminate it. So not only were these guys Catholic bishops that predated Constantine, but they were Catholic bishops, you know, at the cost of their lives or their health, and had suffered manfully for their faith in the Catholic Church. So I don't particularly care which history textbook you pick up. Could be written by a Catholic, could be written by, you know, a Martian. Go get anyone. Go read the history of the first four centuries of the Christian Church. You will find that it was not started by Constantine.
Okay. Patrick, thank you so much for your email. Here's one now from an anonymous texter who says, how do you feel about this statement? I feel that a lot of people who leave the Catholic Church leave because they are missing a type of Bible study and worship. That's why they are feeling so spiritually fed from other Christian services. What do you think?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So we have some statistical survey data on this question. When you ask people who leave the Catholic Church, why did you leave the Catholic Church? 70% of those who left will say that their quote-unquote spiritual needs were not being met, unquote.
Okay.
Now, would that number go up or down if Catholics did more Bible study? I don't know. I'm not particularly interested in framing the question that way. What is of interest to me is simply that a significant number of people who are in the Catholic Church fail to understand or don't learn or are not taught how to take what the Catholic Church has to offer and make it relevant for their own spiritual condition and their moral life. That could be due to a failure of catechesis in their particular community. But it might also be due to some failure in their own family life or culture. It could be for other reasons. The Catholic Church, I believe, is relatively difficult to assimilate in comparison to some other religious groups. And there are some religious bodies out there, you can get the whole thing inside a little tiny yellow booklet about 4 pages long, and you pretty much know the whole system.
Mm.
Catholic Church isn't like that. I mean, I'm holding the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It's a big book.
It is.
A lot of stuff in there. Why? I mean, why does that matter? Why should we have a big book, right? Catholic faith is rich with wisdom. Wisdom does not come cheap. It's replete with holiness. Holiness does not come cheap. It's a pricey proposition. So, you know, part of what we want to do on this show in EWTN is to try to make the riches of the Catholic Church accessible and intelligible to people. And quite frankly, it's a full-time job.
Yeah, it is. All right, thank you so much for that text. Here's a question now from Ben watching us on Facebook. Last night in an RCIA session, the class leader said that the 40 men sent out by Jesus were apostles because of this. Is this accurate?
72. Right?
Not 40.
Yeah, not 40. And, well, we can kind of equivocate on the meaning of the word apostle, right? So the word apostle just means one who has been sent. And so in that sense, well, having been sent directly by Christ, you know, if they didn't have, if you want to differentiate like apostle with a capital A, apostle with a small A, you know, but they weren't the 12. And the 12 have a special status in the Christian church. I mean, that's the foundation. When St. Paul speaks about being built, the church being built on the foundation of the prophets and apostles, he's really talking about the 12. And Paul himself was of equal status. Well, in a sense, he didn't have the privilege of having seen Jesus the Lord in the flesh in his historical life. He did meet the risen Christ. But he was appointed especially as the apostle, the apostle to the Gentiles, right? And there were others who were sent. There were others who had commissions. There were others who preached the gospel. They didn't have the status or the stature of Paul and the 11.
Very good. All right, we'll be back in just a few seconds here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Stay with us. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, well, looks like we have some lines open for you right now. Here's another text that just came in from Robert. Would Sheol, S-H-E-O-L, be the equivalent to purgatory?
Thank you. So, in the Old Testament, you find a number of ways that the life after death are referred to, and it would seem that in the mind of the earliest Hebrews, they didn't have a highly differentiated understanding of the afterlife, and Sheol just was the abode of the dead, kind of vanilla, the abode of the dead. In light of further Christian revelation, we have a more specific understanding of the abode of the dead, both before and after the coming of Christ. So we can certainly fit an understanding of purgatory to within the Old Testament concept, but they're not simple equivalents.
Okay, very good. Here's a text now from Dennis. I'm trying to understand Catholics. Is Jesus corporally present in the Eucharist, or just spiritually? In other words, are you chewing a literal part of Jesus' body or not?
Okay, thanks. What the Church teaches is that the substance of bread and wine change to the substance of the body and blood of Christ. Now, that's a very nuanced statement.
It is.
When we say the substance, we don't mean physical presence as you normally understand it, because when I normally encounter a physical substance, like, say, a Tom Price radio co-host. I have substance together with all of the properties or qualities or accidents that flow from that substance. Your substance or essence is, you know, human being, rational person. And you have things like height and weight and you know, all this kind of business, right? Color, you know, and none of those things flow from the substance of Christ's body and blood as they are present in the Blessed Sacrament. So it really is Jesus, but in a mode that is quite mysterious. It's not simply symbolic or figurative. It's a real presence. It's a real presence. It is a bodily presence, but it's a bodily presence in a very mysterious mode. Now, to your question, am I chewing a literal body? Yes, but not in the way you think. Because if I take, say, a steak and I chew it up, I destroy the substance of the steak by chewing, right? And I have a piece of steak over here and this piece of steak over there. I can take a knife and cut it down the middle and that cut it in half. If I break the sacred host in half, I don't actually quantitatively limit the body of Christ in its physical extension. Because I don't have, say, the 5-foot, 740-poundness of Jesus present. And so I have, I continue to have all of the substance of Christ's body and blood over here and all of the substance of Christ's body and blood over there. And if I break those pieces, subdivide them again, yet again, I've got all of them here, all of them here, all of them here, all of them here. I haven't multiplied. No, I have four Jesuses, but neither do I have, you know, four quarter Jesuses. Mm-hmm. The quantitative extensional properties of Christ's body are not present, but his substance is. You go, well, I don't understand that. And I go, welcome to the club. This is one of the mysteries of divine revelation, that we really do have the presence of Christ, bodily presence of Christ, the substantial presence of Christ, but in a mode that escapes our senses and our rational understanding. It's one of the mysteries of the faith, like the Trinity or mm-hmm. like the incarnation of the two natures of Christ. True, because God revealed it, but mysterious.
Dennis, thank you so much for your text. We do appreciate that. And if you're ready now, let's go to the phones here on Call to Communion at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here is Ann in Columbus, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Ann, what's on your mind today?
Yes. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask why we don't have, the Bible as a lesson. You know, our kids are at school, like maybe elementary school, they study a lot of things, math, science, all those stuff. So when I see the way the kids, they are a little bit lost today. And I know before we decided to separate, politics with the church staff or all this story. But for me, it doesn't make sense, especially when we are in the country as the U.S., when you can see that everywhere we say in God we trust, on money, when you are going to the court, you have to swear on the Bible, whatever you are, Muslim. I mean, whatever religion you are, you have to swear. So that means we trust in God, anyhow. So I'm just lost when I can see that in public school there is no lesson for the kids about God, about the Bible, and we know that the first teaching or learning or to have like knowledge and have wisdom and grown up, like a good person in this life, is when you understand what is God means, what is God's purpose on everybody in this world. So, when I listen to the radio, since then we have good speakers like you, like everyone. We know how to teach our kids. Why we cannot allow ourselves to have maybe like a law or something to say that our kids need to learn about the Bible. It's not about the religion.
Okay.
It's about learning about God. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah. I really appreciate the question. And the public schools in the United States used to teach the Bible. And believe it or not, that is why the Catholic Church in the United States would not encourage Catholic parents to send their kids to public schools. In fact, in some cases, they positively forbade Catholics to send their children to public schools because the people doing the teaching of the Bible were Protestants who were deeply anti-Catholic, very prejudiced against the Catholic Church. And so when they started teaching the Bible in the public school, they would teach it in a way that was deliberately intended to undermine the Catholic faith. And so...
Is this like the 19th century?
Sure, yes, okay. And in the early 20th as well. And so we have a great saint in the United States, John Neumann, who established the first diocesan Catholic school system in the country in Philadelphia. And he was a polyglot. He knew a bunch of languages. He was a brilliant administrator, and he went out and started schools for many immigrant Catholics that were very poor, couldn't afford public schools, and made sure to have people that could help people in their own languages and so forth, and did a tremendous amount to preserve and hand down the Catholic faith within the system of Catholic schools. And this remains to be a mandate for the Catholic Church in North America. And, you know, we mentioned some people can't afford Catholic schools. Well, if you live in a community where there are Catholic diocesan or religious Catholic schools and people can't afford them, well, let's get busy making them affordable. And there are a lot of ways to do that. So many places have a situation where you can participate in scholarship programs to fund Catholics in various ways, you know, in collaboration or not with the state government system and, you know, get involved with the scholarship programs, make grants, give donations, volunteer your time. There's at least one Catholic diocese in the United States that has a policy of making Catholic education free for all Catholics. And the whole diocese is kind of piled in on working together to make that possible. So let's support Catholic education so kids can learn their Catholic faith and learn how to navigate these difficult cultural waters that we live in.
And we hope that's helpful for you. Thank you so much for your call. And that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-8255. EWTN, that's 833-288-3986. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Glad you're with us today. Here now is Travis in Linwood, Washington, listening on our great partner there, Sacred Heart Radio. Travis is a first-time caller. Hey, Travis, what's on your mind today?
All right, so the more I learn about Catholicism, you know, being a Protestant for 26 years, the more I want to become one. Now, that being said, when I go to the church, so far the last three times they've offered communion, it just seemed wrong for me to take it at the Protestant church. It's almost like, it seems like, what's the point? And so I don't want to be offensive to the people around me, and I don't want to be offensive, more importantly, to God by doing that. But it just seems like I should not be doing that.
Thanks, Travis. I appreciate the question. Since you have come to that place in your own spiritual journey where you no longer believe in the divine institution of the rites within your Protestant church, then I think you make the correct judgment that you do not want to profess with your actions something that you do not believe. You would be involved in the kind of performative contradiction, and that's sort of like a lie without using words.
Yeah.
And it would wound your own conscience. So I think you're making the right decision. So the question is, like, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to move forward? Well, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I mean, one question that occurs to me is, well, why not begin attending Catholic Mass? You won't actually be able to receive communion in a Catholic Mass until you become Catholic, but you can participate. You can say the prayers. You can hear the readings, listen to the homily, begin to get something of the rhythm of the Catholic life going on as you discern whether or not you're going to actually formally become a Catholic. And You know, so you may have other reasons, familial reasons or other obligations that keep you tied to the Protestant worship service for the time being. But to be sure, if this violates your conscience, then you can't violate conscience. I mean, that's kind of like where the buck stops.
Yeah.
You violate your conscience, you lose everything.
Sure. Travis, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate that. Call to Communion here on EWTN. There's a line open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Carla's checking us out on Facebook today. Carla says, I'm not Catholic, but I'm just wondering about this. Can a non-Catholic receive last rites from a Catholic priest?
With conditions.
Okay.
Yes. So, first of all, if you are genuinely in danger of death, or if a, you know, say a Protestant Christian is genuinely in danger of death, and has Catholic faith in the sacraments. So you have to actually believe that the sacraments do what the Catholic Church says they do, and you're in danger of death, then yes. Yes, you can. So you can receive the sacrament of penance, absolution, and anointing, and viaticum, which is that final Holy Communion. Now, what I'd like to see, if somebody's in danger of death and they have Catholic faith in the sacraments and they're conscious, let's go ahead and get the whole kit and caboodle.
Sure.
Let's make a profession of faith. Let's get confirmed. Let's die Catholic. Right? But yes, there are situations in which that can happen.
Okay. Carla, thanks for checking us out today on Facebook. It is Called to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to a call right now from our listener comment line.
My name is Tim. What's the difference from Jehovah's Witnesses and the Catholics?
Oh, thanks very much. I really appreciate the question. Quite a few differences, in fact. So here's a big difference. The Catholic Church was founded by Jesus Christ in the first century, and the Jehovah's Witnesses were founded in the 19th century by Jeremiah Russell. And he found himself a Greek New Testament, and he knew, as I say, just enough Greek to be dangerous. He was not a Greek scholar, and so he misunderstood what he read, but he was supremely confident in his own intellectual ability, and so he made a very old error, which was to deny the full divinity of our Lord. And then thought he'd come up with something original and started the Watchtower Society and Kingdom Hall and so forth to propagate his errors. And then he and the organization that he founded went on to make all kinds of pronouncements about the end of time, all of which have been shown to be wrong. So multiple times this organization has predicted specific historical events that have failed to take place. And we know what the Old Testament says about listening to prophets that predict cataclysms that fail to come to pass. They're not to be listened to.
Yeah. Okay. And we thank you for that. I do appreciate that call from our listener comment line, which is open 24 hours a day. Here's our phone number right now, and that is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Quick text here from David. If God doesn't need us, why did he create us?
Because goodness is diffusive, and God is goodness itself. He is love itself, and because it is consistent with his own nature to allow his glory to be diffused, right, and to be recognized and acknowledged and shared by other rational creatures. And so out of sheer benevolence, not because of anything lacking within him, but because he's pure love, he made us to share in his love.
Beautiful thing. We do appreciate that, and thank you so much for your, that was a text from David. If you would like to get with us here today on EWTN's Call to Communion, we have a line for you right now, and that number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. In a moment, we'll be talking with Andy in Columbus, Ohio, also Mary Ann in South Bend, Indiana. There's a line open for you as well here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Stay with us. Glad you're with us here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Our phone number, it looks like we have two lines open right now, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. Here's Andy in Columbus, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio, and he's a first-time caller. Hello, Andy. What's on your mind today?
Hello, Mr. Anders. So I've had a question about Mary and kind of the difference between veneration and worship. I was just wondering, you know, like in terms of like bowing down to Mary and like worship, seemingly worshiping, you know, what's the difference between veneration and worship?
Sure. Yeah, I really appreciate the question. So the here I live in Alabama, and we are football fans down here. Well, everybody but me, right? They're all football fans. And when the team comes out on the field, and down here it's either Alabama or Auburn, you go for
that's
one or the other.
Pretty much it.
You see some people go nuts, right? And they jump up and down, and they hoot and holler, and they carry on with all kinds of gesticulations. And we understand very well that, well, you might have your doubts, but like in principle, it's not worship. It's not an act of worship. It might be veneration. Maybe it's some hyperventilation too.
That's
right?
True.
But it's not actually an act of worship. And when we visit, say, the monuments of fallen heroes, we go to nation's capital and we see the Lincoln Memorial or the Washington Memorial or mm-hmm. something, or you know, visit the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or whatnot, and you know, hear the national anthem and you put your hand over your heart or salute the flag or whatever it might be. These are all acts of reverence, devotion, fandom in some cases, some kind of reverence is being displayed. When we go to the court and we, you know, we say, I pray the court to hear, grant me relief. And mm-hmm. well, your honor, well, I don't know if the guy's honorable or not, right? But it's a term of respect and reverence for the office. All right. All of these things are ways of showing a certain kind of reverence that is due to either a temporal lord, right, government official, sports team, fallen hero. You can imagine if we still lived in the time of kings, go back to medieval Europe, and you would go to the court, and of course would you make acts of obeisance, and you would kneel and bow and bob and do whatever you needed to do to curry favor with the monarch or with the monarch's lackeys and hangers-on, if you mm-hmm. needed that kind of access to the royalty, of course you would. And you might even use some pretty elevated language. You know, you could imagine if you've got an inside track to go see the king. King's not used to talking to folks like me, and I got an inside track. I might go and say, you know, dear Lord Bob, you're my only hope, right? Take these droids to my father. Right? You know, I mean, you could use some pretty wild language
sure.
to show how indebted you are, how in great need you are for this individual to plead your case with the monarch. Right? In none of these cases is it an act of worship. Now, how would you know the difference? Okay, well, let's say I go to Lord Bob at the court, and I carry a chicken and a knife with me. And he says, what are you doing with the chicken and the knife? I said, well, I'm getting ready to set up an altar, and I'm going to slaughter this bird and pour its blood on the altar, and I'm going to offer it to you as a holocaust in propitiation for my sins. And Lord Bob says, Anders, you're nuts. You do not offer sacrifice to me. And that's the distinction, that worship essentially involves the act of sacrifice. And ritual sacrifice.
Sure.
And all acts of reverence and veneration that would be due to temporal authorities are just that. They're just tokens of respect as we seek either to honor or ask for the help or intercession of some intermediary, and vastly different kinds of activities. And one of the reasons that many Protestants have a hard time understanding the distinction between latria and dulia, or worship and veneration mm-hmm. that Catholics perform, is because Protestants no longer practice any form of sacrifice as a part of their public cult or worship. Because in the 16th century, Protestants were very adamant in rejecting the sacrificial character of the Mass, even more than the doctrine of the real presence. Martin Luther, in particular, who believed in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, adamantly denied that the Mass was a sacrifice. And once you make the claim that Christian worship is not principally an act of sacrifice, well, then it's obscure what worship consists in.
Mm.
But it's not obscure to Catholics. We know what worship is. Worship is, St. Paul says in Romans 12, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. Mm. This is your spiritual act of worship. He uses the word latria for worship, latrion logikē, spiritual act of worship. And that's what we do with Almighty God. And when you attend to the language of the Mass, you listen to the Eucharistic prayers, what the priest says, essentially, is calls the entire church, including the saints and angels, together as one body, corporately, to then make this act, this offering, this oblation of the body and blood of Christ to God in reparation for our sins. You'll see in the language of the Mass that the saints are our collaborators in this. They're not the recipients of the worship of the Mass. They are co-offerers with us of the sacrifice of the Mass. And our essential equality with the saints as creatures and supplicants mm-hmm. is extremely evident, very evident. Now, when it comes to our private prayers and our act of intercession, I'll turn to Tom Price and ask him to pray for me. And his prayers are pretty good. But St. Francis's are better.
No doubt.
And the Blessed Virgin's are even better on top of that. And so just like the medieval peasant going to court, I might use elevated language. Blessed Mother of God. Help. You know, help of Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Queen of Heaven. You're the one that's going to get this thing done for me. But because she operates as a mediator and an intercessor.
Andy, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate hearing from you listening to St. Gabriel Radio today. It is called to communion here on EWTN. A couple lines open at the moment, 833-288-3986. That's 833-288-EWTN. Marianne is listening in South Bend, Indiana on Redeemer Radio. Marianne, what's on your mind today?
Well, I want to first tell you thank you so much for your program. I've been Catholic my whole life, but I learn so much. It's incredible. But the question I had today was, if a person, after they're raised Catholic, leaves the faith, believes they're no longer Catholic, gets married outside of the faith, can a Catholic go to that wedding? Or, I mean, I heard the conversation just before the last one where he said, you know, you would be participating, witnessing to something that wasn't truly accurate. So... Can a Catholic person attend that wedding, or no, we can't?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So there's a little bit of a difference here. It's not quite an analogy to the earlier caller who wanted to know if he should receive communion in a Protestant church. Because to really make it an analogy, you'd have to say, well, you know, could I participate in the wedding as one of the spouses? And the answer to that would be emphatically no. No, you can't, right? But could you show up at the celebration as a relative, right? And that, I would say, is more of a matter of prudential judgment, right? And what would I consider? What kind of factors would I consider? Well, you know, there's a spiritual work of mercy called, well, we've got teaching the ignorant, instructing the ignorant, and admonishing the sinner. But we don't teach every ignorant person, and we don't admonish every sinner. We'd be really terrible dinner guests if we did, right? And so you have to use some judgment about, well, when do I actually perform this work of mercy and admonish the sinner and tell him they're doing something wrong? Well, Catholic theologians offer three criteria. I think they're very helpful. Number one, it's a serious thing. Well, this is a serious thing. Number two, they're probably going to listen to me. I have some well-founded expectation that my words will be heeded. And third, I'm the best person to make the admonition. So... they're probably going to listen. They're going to listen to me better than somebody else, and it really matters. Sometimes that happens, and you got to make the admonition. I mean, that's especially true, like with members of your own family, your kids, and stuff like that. Not always. Sometimes your kids don't listen, right? A lot of times they don't listen. But I wouldn't just go out and make that admonition to any Tom, Dick, and Harry. If you have a pretty well-founded expectation, this person doesn't consider themselves Catholic at all, doesn't have any regard for the authority or the teaching of the Catholic Church, there's just no way that they're going to heed this admonition. And in fact, they're going to just chalk it up to Catholics being pedantic and nitpicking over their silly rules, and at the risk of losing any further influence in that person's life for the next 20 years, and an occasion to disabuse them of their false notions of the Catholic faith? Well, you know, you might say, okay, because I really know this person is ignorant of what they're doing and is operating in good faith, wasn't well instructed in the Catholic faith, doesn't have an understanding of why they ought to regard her teaching as authoritative, and is in her his or her own way actually trying to contract something like a Christian marriage, maybe I'm going to judge that it's better for me to continue to have access to the family so that, you know, with hope and over time, I'm able to bring them to a better understanding of the Catholic position, and maybe one day they can be have their marriage convalidated in the church.
All right.
That's a judgment call for you to make.
Okay. Mary Ann, thank you so much for your call. It is called Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Dallas now and talk with Cher, listening on Guadalupe Radio, our longtime partner there in the Dallas area. Hey, Cher, what's on your mind today?
Hello. I had a question about the Ten Commandments. When it talks about keep holy the Sabbath, and I think that in my mind, I just want a clarification of it. In my mind, it keep holy the Sabbath meant the set what used to be the day, the seventh day of rest or whatever, so the last day of the week, right? So I'm thinking Saturday, the last day of the week. But then I think, and with our Ten Commandments, I always hear keep holy the Lord's Day, which is because after Jesus rose from the dead, that became the day of rest, the day, special day or whatever, not Sabbath anymore, which I guess is Jewish. I mean, so I'm just curious how that, if you were writing a Catholic Ten Commandments, if it's written somewhere, would it say keep holy the Lord's Day or will it say keep holy the Sabbath?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So the Jewish seventh day Sabbath does not bind the conscience of the Christian man or woman. And in fact, this is the explicit teaching of the New Testament. St. Paul in the book of Colossians chapter 2 says, do not let them say to you that you have to celebrate a new moon festival, a Sabbath day, or any date from the Jewish calendar. Because there's a, you know, the people of Israel had not just the Sabbath, but they had a whole system of sacrificial worship tied to places and times that were peculiar to, specific to, the civil condition of Israel under the Mosaic Law. And they had a conception, many of the Jews at the time of Christ had a conception, it was a false one, that in order to be reconciled to the God of Abraham, it would be necessary for anyone, Gentile or not, to come fully within the corporate civil structure of Israel and live as if they were ethnically Jewish in order to be reconciled with God. And that was the understanding. And even some of the earliest Christians who came over from Judaism had that conception. And the church said, no, you've got the thing wrong, right? Because the promise to Abraham that he would be heir of the world and that his descendants would be a blessing to all nations, that preceded God's revelation to Moses. And the Mosaic Law was for a time and for a people, so that they might bear witness to the God of Abraham in the world, but the ultimate plan of God was to reconcile everybody, Jew and Gentile alike, to the one God through the Savior Jesus Christ. And so, for Christians, that whole system of Mosaic Law doesn't apply, does not apply, don't have to do it. Now, there is, however, in the Ten Commandments as a whole are more than just, you know, 10 out of, you know, 600 plus Mosaic laws. These 10 are particularly important because they correspond to some of the highest moral truths that we can know even from the natural law. Even without God's revelation in Scripture, we can discern these as principles just from our consideration, our rational consideration of the created order. The first three commandments have to do with the honor of God, both in our own hearts and in our civil or corporate life. And it doesn't take, you don't have to think very hard to realize that God is God and I'm not, and I owe him reverence and thanksgiving. You know, St. Josephine Bakita, one of my favorites, long before she was a Catholic, before she knew anything about Jesus, tells us that she would go out and look at the sun, moon, and stars and say, who made these things? Who made them? And she was filled with a desire to thank him, pay him homage and reverence. That's right and just, right? And so the first three commandments correspond to these truths written into our heart and our nature in the natural law. And one of those is that we owe God corporate worship. Now, it is appropriate, it is most appropriate for a Christian that that collective and corporate public worship be offered in commemoration of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, which is the key event in salvation history, which is why the early church developed the habit of meeting on the first day of the week to celebrate the resurrection of Christ from the dead. And that's why it is a precept of the church. It's a divine positive law, right, commanded through the church, that we continue that practice. And we have that moral obligation. And as such, we are fulfilling that deeper law embedded in the third commandment about the necessity of giving God corporate, public, and regular worship.
Great question. Thank you so much, Cher, for your call. It is called Communion here on EWTN. Just a reminder, if you missed part or all of this show or any of our shows on EWTN, you can check out the podcast. You know, we post, I believe it's 11 per day podcasts. That's an awful lot of podcasts, almost 70 per week. So to check out any of our great shows via podcasting, you'll want to go to EWTN.com/radio/podcasts. That's all you have to do. You can tune in, listen, subscribe, download, whatever you want to do. They're all right there at EWTN.com/radio/podcasts. Back to it right now for Tom in Huntingtown, Maryland, listening on Guadalupe Radio, a first-time caller. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I have a question for the doctor about, it's in one of the Gospels, after they arrest Jesus, they mention somebody runs off naked, leaving behind a linen cloth. And I always just wondered why they put that in there, and did that have a meaning, or... And did he know who it was? I've heard people mention that it might be John, and I've read somewhere else that some people thought it was Mark.
Yeah, thanks. So I think the reason that they put it in there is because it happened, and it may very well have been Mark, and Mark is also called John Mark,
mm-hmm.
And that's one of the earliest traditions about the identity of the naked fugitive, and it would make sense, right, that... in the reminiscences of the gospel, that if he is actually the amanuensis who's writing down the gospel, for St. Peter, that he would stick himself in there, right? And Sometimes the sacred writers do this, and we can kind of detect their personalities behind the gospel. Here's a good example, a parallel example with St. Luke. In all of the gospels, we read about this woman with an issue of blood. And she touches the hem of Christ's garment, and he heals her. And mm-hmm. and some of the gospel accounts say that she wasted all of her money on physicians. She spent everything she had, and the physicians exploited or took advantage of her, and she couldn't get healed. Luke's account says no physician was able to heal her. Now Luke was a doctor. So he wasn't knocking on members of his profession. He kind of qualified the statement a little bit, little bit of his personality sneaking in there, uh-huh. And so perhaps John Mark, we don't know. I mean, this is speculation, but there's a tradition that he is actually the amanuensis who takes down the reminiscences of St. Peter. Maybe he's tucked himself in there.
Could be.
And, could you then derive an allegorical significance to fleeing naked? Of course. I mean, all day long you could come up with applications like that.
Yeah. Very good, Tom. Thank you so much for your question. Tina sent us a text saying, Joel Osteen on TV states that the more we tithe, the more we will open the windows of prosperity and healing. The poor can only tithe on a fixed income. He said, God doesn't want us sick and wants prosperity for us. Is this true?
So, appreciate the question. And I don't really want to talk about individual people and their opinions, but I will talk in a general terms about the so-called health and wealth gospel, which is prominent in some Pentecostal churches. This particular message is extremely profitable for the leaders of ecclesiastical organizations who effectively peddle it. It's not very effective for the people that typically fund their limousines, right? I mean, so there are some extraordinarily wealthy, phenomenally, exorbitantly wealthy Protestant ministers that have huge estates and properties, many times owned by their ministries, and so they escape government taxation that way by claiming it as a... I've got no one in mind in particular. Honestly, I really don't, but this is something I've read about with the tax laws.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it, you know, by soliciting donations and promising people spiritual and sometimes material benefits in consequence of their gifts. And it's interesting that there are no end of poor people that continue to fund this kind of operation. And the sad thing is that, I mean, I invite you to visit. I don't really want you to visit, but you might investigate at some remove some of these health and wealth congregations, and you'll find that they're full of sick poor people.
Okay.
They're just full of sick poor people. So they're not actually getting rich, except the people peddling the message, and they're not actually getting well. And it's a great cruelty. And because I have known people to come out of these movements, and many times they have incredible suffering in their life, but now they have the added burden of guilt, a false guilt, because they believe, well, if only I had more faith, my feet would grow back. You know, I lost my feet because of my diabetes, and I'm blind, and I'm in a wheelchair, and everything's falling apart on me, and if only I had greater faith, my body parts would grow back, and I wouldn't be like this. That's horrible. What a terrible thing to burden. And I've known people with that specific situation, that specific burden. What a horrible thing to burden another human being with that kind of guilt. Now, nothing in sacred scripture or tradition teaches us this. On the contrary, the message of the gospel is that when you become a Christian, you better look out because suffering is coming your way. Yeah. Big time. Mm-hmm. Heavy duty. And St. Paul says that we will only reign with Christ in glory if we also suffer with him. That's what he says, Romans chapter 8. And Christ tells us that unless we take up our cross and follow him in the way of suffering, then we're not going to be saved. And I would invite anyone to spend some time living in the Psalms. Psalms are not, by and large, happy chapters. It's a lot of, God, everybody's left me, my body's wasting away, my tongue is cleaving to my palate, my enemies are crushing me to the ground, and my one companion is darkness. Help. That's a lot of the Psalms. And that's the prayer of the church. Not that God will eliminate suffering from our life, but that he gives us an opportunity to find meaning in suffering by uniting it to the cross of Christ for our salvation and the good of the church.
Tina, thank you so much for your text. Here is a call now from John in Seattle, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Hello, John. What's on your mind today?
Hey, morning, or good afternoon, as the case may be.
Howdy.
The other day, I heard you talking to somebody about Ulrich Zwingli and his the foundations of his belief that the sacraments are not worthy of pretty much anything, and how he discounted the belief of the real presence in the Eucharist. And I wanted to bounce off of you what sources I can find to read up on that besides just Wikipedia and that kind of stuff, because it's that sort of fascinated me, because I've been in discussions with like this Church of Christ guy here recently that you know, about the real presence in the Eucharist, and it's, I give them the scriptural references, but they always seem to want they always seem to have their own little argument. So anyway, that's essentially what I was wondering about.
Sure. So, a number of sources. One of them, I would encourage you to read Zwingli for yourself. And the Westminster Press has a volume of texts translated into English by Zwingli and Bullinger, edited by G.W. Bromley, which is a common one that you'll find circulating in seminaries and whatnot. That was my first approach to Zwingli. And so you'd read them yourself. And Zwingli is treated in almost any Reformation history. Timothy George, recently retired dean of Beeson Divinity School, has a delightful little volume on the theology of the Reformers, including a good chapter on Zwingli. And if you want to know specifically about the kind of iconoclastic theology that animated Zwingli and some of his contemporaries, is a good book by Carlos Iyer called The War Against Idols. And it's about iconoclasm in the Reformation. And IR Now has a real doorstopper of a history of the Reformation that's also pretty good. So, but, you know, Zwingli's a very important figure in the 16th century, and so almost any text on Reformation studies is going to have a good analysis of Zwingli.
Very good. All right, there's some great resources for you there, John. And if you want to hear that again, you can go to the podcast by checking out EWTNradio.net, EWTNradio.net. We should have that posted for you very, very quickly. Dr. David Andrews, we answered phone calls, emails, texts, YouTube, Facebook. I think we got a lot done this hour.
Well, you know, I guess that social media thing works, doesn't it?
Apparently so. Mother Angelica was always about, let's be where the people are. That's why we've always been early adopters of new technology. Thanks so much for your contributions today.
You.
We do the radio program Monday through Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern, with an encore at 11 p.m. Eastern. On behalf of Charles, Ryan, and Jeff, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Andrews. You have a great day. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.